Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community and in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. There is absolutely nothing funny about cancer or about losing someone whom you love. Nevertheless, Nora McInerney Permort's memoir called It's Okay to Laugh, Crying is Okay Too, contains a surprising amount of humor, even as it also traces the heartbreaking story of meeting, falling in love with her husband Aaron, and then losing him to cancer. Nora McInerney Permort is a talented writer whose work has appeared in the Huffington Post and Cosmopolitan magazine, among other places. Her book is published by Day Street, which is a division of William and Morrow. We began our interview by having Nora McInerney Permort describe the basic outline of her life with her husband, Aaron.
So I met Aaron. I was in my late 20s. I just moved back to Minneapolis after living in New York City for 5 years, and we met at an art gallery, and we had been following each other on Twitter before that, so quite a modern romance. And we dated for a year before he had a seizure at work, and the seizure turned out to be a brain tumor, and the brain tumor turned out to be cancer, and we were married a month after his first brain surgery, and right before he, you know, got deep into chemo and radiation and treatment. And Aaron lived with brain cancer, with glioblastoma, which is a specifically terrible kind of brain cancer. I don't think there's a good brain cancer, but it's, you know, definitely the worst one, in my opinion. You know, we had a baby, and we just had a really happy, normal marriage until it basically took over, and he got very, very sick. He died in November 2014, 6 weeks after my dad died of cancer as well, and 7 weeks after I miscarried our second baby. Mm.
So you've tasted some sorrow, a lot more sorrow than someone your age probably ever expects to have to experience in their life. Talk for a moment about what precipitated the actual writing of this memoir, and what that experience was like.
Well, Aaron and I were just sort of internet people, you know, like we sort of met on Twitter, I guess. And I had started a blog when he was sick called myhusbandstumor.com, and I started it, you know, for a pretty practical reason. I wanted to have a place where I could update our friends and family, you know, without sending 100 text messages and making sure I put everybody on, you know, update emails. But really, I think that at the core of what I was doing was trying to have some sort of agency over the way our story was told. It's really hard for people to watch you go through something hard, and sickness and grief are isolating because you lose a lot more people than just the person who died. People are afraid of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, and so often they say or do nothing. And I didn't want to be a sad story that people whispered about. I didn't want Aaron to be that, because he was so delightfully, magnetically alive for, you know, until his last, you know, week of life. And so I really wanted to force people to see us for who we really were, not just as a cancer story, but as a life story and as a love story.
So in a sense, it was a way and remains a way to take hold of the story and not let other people turn it into something that it was not.
Right. And, you know, nobody wants your pity. It's a pretty useless emotion. And it's, you know, it's kind of the first one that we give to people when something that we consider unimaginable happens. And, you know, even, you know, the fact is, like, these things that happen to me are terrible and they're sad, but they happen to everyone. And we don't get to go through life without, you know, tasting these sorrows. And it really is like the full spectrum of life is not just all of these like happy, shiny parts like babies and marriage and, you know, promotions, but it is loss. And, you know, grief is the cost of loving somebody. Like, I chose to love somebody deeply, and the risk is that you can always lose anybody you love. 100%, you have 100% chance of it happening eventually.
Right. The second chapter of the book is titled Now, and it's where you talk about a lot of what you were thinking and feeling and experiencing right around the time that you and Aaron actually got married. You describe what you were going through and what you were trying to feel at one point by saying, I fought the urge to try to feel things before they happened and instead tried to feel what was actually happened. I think this is called being present or living your life, but it was a really new concept for me. And it blew my mind in the same way discovering that Lumiere in Beauty and the Beast is voiced by Jerry Orbach from Law and Order.
A lot of people who read my book have been surprised at that fact. So I've gotten a lot of messages. I'm like, I know. It's very shocking.
Yes. But this is a moment where there's this diagnosis and this scary reality, and what is so easy to do is be swept along into all kinds of feelings about what is down the road and how terrible things are going to become. And you are really trying to remain anchored in the present moment. To the extent that the day before you get married, you get a tattoo. And tell our listeners about that.
I have a little tattoo on the inside of my wrist that I covered up as I was walking down the aisle like my dad was going to, you know, reprimand me or not let me get to the altar. And it's just a small cursive word, and it says now, and it's right where, you know, a watch band would be. And so I look at it every day, and it reminds me to try to stay where I am and not to, like I said, not to try on feelings before they actually happen, because I spent so much of my life being anxious and worried about, you know, all of these, you know, potentialities that really never came to pass. And even though I did, you know, that first night when we found out Aaron had a brain tumor, I did imagine him dying. It was nothing. There's no amount of worrying that can prepare you for any actual event. There isn't. And all that does is pull us out of the experience that we're having now. It's just such a waste of time. So I try not to do that anymore.
Right. The reason I started with this is not just because this is a relatively early chapter in the book, but because I kind of wondered about the experience of writing this memoir and how, in a sense, that was to any extent at odds with what you were just talking about in terms of living in the present moment, staying anchored to the present. And it sounds like your natural tendency has been to sweep ahead prematurely and worry about the future. And maybe you're not someone who has evaded the present by looking back too much. But I wonder then, did it feel odd in any way to be spending so much time with your own past, particularly with a past that was rife with so much sorrow and loss?
You know, in a lot of ways, it felt like I was finally seeing it for the first time. When you're actually going through something like this, which was, you know, Aaron was sick for 3 years. We had a child. My dad became sick in the last, 5 months of Aaron's life. There's not a lot of time to sit back and reflect on what's happening, because it's you who has to keep your world moving, who has to make sure that, you know, and there's so many people on the planet who will listen to this and be like, yep, someone has to like wake up and, you know, make breakfast for everybody and make sure there's groceries and get to work and make sure your bills are paid and make sure, you know, everyone has like the right doctor's appointments. And, you know, you're doing all of these, there's a lot of like, a lot of administrative tasks with illness. There's a lot, there's just like a long, long to-do list at all these times. So I think because I was so close to everything, I saw Aaron every day. And so I saw him deteriorate, you know, bit by bit to the point where, you know, I could really only see how shocking it was looking back, because it was just my life. This was our normal life. This is our normal. So in some ways it did help me to acknowledge that we had really gone through something that was real and was hard and was also beautiful and sacred. I think to stand up to somebody when they are sick, and say, yes, I will marry you for better, for worse, for sickness and health, you know, is something. And we all say that when we get married, we say basically the same things. But to do it is very different. And it's so, it really is like a beautiful, horrifying, but beautiful experience. And so writing the book and being able to write, you know, our love story and even like go into who I was before Aaron really helped me see just how special what we had was.
Writing
the current experience, like so much, the book was written within six months after he died. Like writing that current mourning experience, like did keep me from worrying too much about the future because, you know, I was going through it. I had a small child and, you know, had a dead husband for 4 months for the writing of most of this book.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So in a sense, it was anchoring you in a sense to that present moment, or that present reality. I'm so glad to know that. I'm curious about the choice that you made, although maybe it wasn't a conscious choice at all, but to structure the book as you did, in a sense, with not too much in the way of structure. I mean, for instance, mm-hmm. I mean, this book has 46 chapters, although they're relatively modest in length,
yeah.
But they do not take us through a tidy chronological arc through your experience. We aren't taken through your courtship in chapter 1 and to the funeral in chapter 46. Is this just the way you had to write it? Or was there, in a sense, a purpose behind the sort of skipping around to various facets of this story that you ended up adopting?
I think that I had to write it this way. I tried to do it in a more traditional way. And writing it as, like, you know, boy meets girl, boy gets cancer, like, boy and girl get married, have a baby, like, lose a baby, he dies. Wasn't a story that I wanted to read and wasn't a story that I wanted to write. And I liked, what I wrote was the most representative of our experience. And I think of a little bit of like that chaotic nature of grief and remembering as well. Which is that, you know, things don't always feel like they just happened in such a linear way, and there is like a lot of remembering, and there is like a lot of laughter, and there is a lot of sadness. So I wrote the book that that felt right to me and felt right to who we were and the experience that I was having.
We're speaking with Nora McInerney Permort about her memoir called "It's Okay to Laugh, Crying is Cool Too." It recounts the experience of when she met a wonderful young man by the name of Aaron, who then not too long thereafter was diagnosed with a rare form of brain cancer. But nevertheless, they were engaged to be married. In fact, got engaged on Aaron's hospital bed, were married, had a baby boy, and then his life was ultimately claimed by cancer, and this memoir looks back on all of that. Before we proceed any further, I think we need to learn more about who Aaron was apart from his cancer.
Yeah, I'd love that.
So what do you want us to know about him?
Oh, God, Aaron was the best. Like, I think, you know, a part of why this book happened was not just the blog, but the fact that Aaron and I wrote his obituary together. And in it, we had said that he died of complications from a radioactive spider bite that had essentially turned him into Spider-Man. And so he died fighting cancer as Spider-Man. And that our son would grow up to avenge his untimely death. And Aaron and I wrote that together. And it was the truest thing that we could have written because Aaron was so funny and so interesting and alive and quirky and warm and made everybody who was around him, even if he only met you once, feel like they were a part of something. The first night we met, it was at a party and he was leaving with his friends and he said, come meet us out. We're going to, you know, this bar in Minneapolis. And I asked my cousin, who was my ride that night, like, can we please go? Like, I think this boy is so cute. Like, I think he likes me. And she's like, fine. And we get there and he's at a table of 30 people. And I thought to myself, oh no, like he just invited everyone. Like he wasn't asking me out. And he stood up like at this whole table of people who are strangers to me and friends to him and pulled up two chairs, one for me and my cousin right next to him, and introduced us to everybody and made me a part of, you know, his circle of friends and a part of his evening and a part of his life. And that's just how he was. He was magnetically alive. We could not go anywhere in the city without running into somebody who was, you know, his friend. And by friend, I mean, you know, someone he met once at a party or worked with, you know, 5 years ago or, you know, went to high school with. He's just that kind of person.
Hmm. What kind of a difference did he make in your own life? Maybe another way to ask that is, what sort of a departure was he, or what sort of a different relationship was this compared to what you had experienced thus far in your brief young adulthood?
Oh boy. Oh man. yeah. gosh, my 20s were hard. Like, dating was hard. Life was hard for no reason. I just felt like I was like doomed to wander the earth alone, like the Incredible Hulk. And part of that was I was just, you know, like meeting the wrong people and then like trying to mold myself like into their lives and into somebody that they would like. And Aaron met me and just liked me and wanted me. And it wasn't difficult and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a game. It wasn't like, oh, should I, you know, is he going to text me in like 2 days? No, he texted me like 2 minutes after he got home the first night we met and made an immediate plan. And we talked, you know, every single day on, you know, Google chat while we were supposed to be working. Like, there was no mystery. There was no, you know, there was no game to it. We liked each other and it was fun. Like, everything was just more fun with him. So he sort of released me from this little, like, self-imposed, self-conscious prison that I'd put myself in and let me just be happy. And he was so encouraging. He was the first person I was always a writer, and he was the first person that I dated who liked that or cared about it, I should say. I had pieces that came out on Tuesdays on two different websites, and he would, you know, text me in the morning, like, what time? Like, I just checked, it's not up. When are they coming out? And he was reading, like, articles that I'd written, like, months before we met about, like, dating other people and, you know, like makeup and just, like, things that were not, you know, necessarily super relevant to him. But he loved them because I made them.
Mm.
And so that's kind of how I think of, you know, this book. Like, what could I make that would be worth what he gave me and would be reflective of, like, who he was?
Right. And, of course, in some respects, this book is also about, in a sense, your coming of age, your becoming an adult. And it's not even that Aaron's cancer made you an adult. I mean, I think some people might kind of jump to that conclusion.
Yeah.
But it's even apart from that. It was just in a sense, meeting someone who loved you for who you were and in a sense allowed you to be exactly who you are versus kind of the misadventures before where you just weren't, in a sense, comfortable with that scenario. One of the things you tell us is that you were an English major and and how, in a sense, an English major can sort of make you feel like the whole world is yours. And on the other hand, it can also be kind of a feel like it's a path to nowhere where there is no clear destination at all. And that can be pretty disconcerting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was definitely a person who was waiting for just for a syllabus in general. And that is, the book is about that, about like trying to figure out like who I am and, you know, not just in context of like falling in love, but also in like becoming a mother and, you know, losing like two huge central figures in my life, my father and my husband. And, you know, I am who I am today because of both of those people and because I lost both of those people. And there's really, you know, no denying that. Also, yeah, I was an English major, and I guess I found my path, but oof, they don't make it easy.
You write, really you write at the end of one chapter, there is no syllabus for life that outlines the steps you need to take to graduate to the next event. This life itself is the lesson and the test, and there is no dean's list and no gold stars. There is just the sum of your relationships and your actions, measured by how you feel when you lie down to go to sleep at night. And how many people heart you tweets.
Yep. Just the important things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was very concerned about doing everything right. And I think that's a very, it's a common thread for people my age, and especially women my age, to let perfectionism or at least the fear of being imperfect keep them from trying things. And keep them from, you know, even thinking they can do anything without somebody's, you know, sort of permission. And maybe not their explicit permission, but without somebody saying, like, no, this is a job that you can apply for. Or no, like, you can quit your job and try to start your own business. Like, there's just, I know so many women who are so risk averse, and we're basically in this little cage that we've built out of, like, imaginary responses from other people when really like it's worth it to try. And I've you know, I basically only tried because the worst things in life had already happened to me.
Right.
So like what else could happen?
One of my favorite chapters in the book is the one called Stories. And
I like that one too.
And among other things, you say that, you know, you always hated the sight of a couple sitting silently at dinner, pushing their food around their plates or ignoring one another in favor of the cool glow of their phones. And you vowed that you were never going to be that person or in that kind of relationship. And you go on to say that in a sense, your relationship with Aaron was as opposite of that as could possibly be. Tell us more about that and how, in a sense, story played a very powerful role in who you were and what drew you together.
Aaron was known for his stories, for the fact that no matter what you were talking about, he had a story to share, that they were so funny, but like not as funny as he found them. Like there was no one who could laugh as hard at his stories as he could. And he loved repeating them. And I had my favorites too, but you know, we were together for 3 years, which a lot of people, you know, that's not that long. My aunt and uncle had been married for like 70 years. So I'm sure they're like three, big deal. But the thing that happy couples that I know, like my aunt and uncle, who have been together since they were 14 years old and live in Milwaukee, they're going to be listening to this. The thing that they have in common is that they really like each other and they like to know what's going on in the other person's head. And Aaron and I every day would just talk. Like at night, he would tell me, I would ask him to tell me like a story and he would reach into like his childhood and into his brain and just tell me things. And they would make me laugh or they would make me cry. but I just loved discovering, you know, new things about him, or even just hearing something about him that I knew I loved.
And you call this your daily ritual, which suggests that it had that sort of presence in your life. It's not just something that you happen to do a lot, but that you made a concerted effort to do each and every day.
Yeah, I would fall asleep to him talking every night. I'd say, tell me a story, and he would tell me a story until I fell asleep. And I would pick him up from work every day, and we would just tell each other what had happened. I miss that. I miss hearing, like, you know, every single thing that happened at his workplace, or telling him every single thing that happened, you know, at mine. We just found each other interesting. And I think there's, like, no substitute for that, like, for finding the person that you love interesting.
Right. I appreciate that in this chapter you also talk about your own father and the stories that that he would sometimes tell, but not often, because he was a private man. In fact, you tell us about how shocked you were when you learned that he was coming to your school to speak to, I forget if it was an English class or a history class or what it was.
Yeah, history class.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was coming to talk about Vietnam. And and he did that because, you know, one of my classmates, one of my best friends had made a comment to the teacher who, you know, was trying to impart on us, you know, that kids were going to Vietnam when they were basically our age, when they were seniors in high school. They were going to graduate and have to go and fight this war. And my friend had said, well, you know, Nora's dad was in Vietnam. He went right after high school. And my teacher called my dad without me knowing it. And my dad agreed to come in and talk to a bunch of, you know, high school kids about this thing that, you know, we had, you know, really not talked about as a family. We were aware of it. He had this little shadow box full of photos and little mementos that was in his office that we never talked about. And I sat there in a classroom with, you know, 25 of my peers and heard my dad tell these stories that he'd never, ever spoken of. And after that, it was like something had lifted, and I was a person that he could talk to about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always considered anything my dad told me about himself like a treasure. Like, it was just like, I loved getting to know him too. I loved hearing, you know, all those stories that, you know, when you're little or when you're a teenager, you know, you almost like, most kids like roll their eyes at, like, I don't care what this corner was when you were a kid. I did care. And I think, you know, I regret now not doing a better job of documenting all of those things. But you always think you have time. And I think now I have to cut myself a break and say, you know, I did what I could to be there and be present with both of these men while they were here. And if I didn't, you know, document it for posterity, that's okay. Like, the people that we love, they become a part of us, and that's how they don't stay alive through us trying to become living museums of them. They just become a part of us, and that has to be good enough, because that's all we get.
Right. And I find so poignant the moment in this chapter, as you're thinking about some of the stories that eventually your father told. You write at one point, just a few months after their deaths, meaning your father's death and your husband, Aaron, I struggle to recall the details of these favorite tales from my husband and my father. Was it fourth or fifth grade when a strange boy at the playground asked to see Aaron's basketball, then kicked it across the highway? How possible is it that I could find that boy today, now an adult male close to 40, and kick his blank? What was my father's company again? 1st Battalion, Alpha Company, 1st Recon Division, the Hawks? No, that's a sports team. No, that's an animal. I mean, there's something really poignant about, you know, wanting to reach, you know, beyond the grave and have these stories back in all of their rich detail. And then you go on to talk about a funeral of someone else. Someone who had been, I think, a schoolmate of yours, someone named Eddie. Tell our listeners about this.
Yeah, a few months after Aaron died, a classmate of mine died, and we'd gone to high school together. He's my age, he's 32, And he had had cancer twice before in his life, when he was 5 and again in high school. And it had come back the year before and it had spread to his brain. And he was so much like Aaron. The two of them met when Eddie got sick and we all had dinner, and they had, you know, they texted each other, I think, about, you know, life and treatment and, you know, stuff like that. But Eddie was just a totally unique human being. So funny and ridiculously wonderful and alive, and had, you know, this huge swath of friends from, you know, grade school and high school and college and work. And he was a person who didn't just tell stories, he gave you stories to tell, because being around Eddie was just so funny. He was just always going to do something hilarious. Everybody has a friend like this. And at his funeral, his cousin was there and was, you know, there was an open microphone, and his cousin wanted to hear stories about, you know, the Eddie that he didn't know. And I remember sitting there and thinking, I know exactly how you feel. I know that these are ways that somebody feels close to you, is knowing just all of these sort of like unknowable pieces of them.
Right.
And I wanted to get up there and tell a story, and I couldn't do it. And so I put it in the book instead.
Mm-hmm. I love this part where you talk about, this is essentially the luncheon after the funeral itself, and you're in this church basement filled with so many people that I do not know, people who Eddie went to college and grade school with, his cousins and his coworkers. We all lead many lives that rarely intersect. It's so uncomfortable for me watching another person's worlds mix together. I can't imagine how I'll feel watching my own funeral as a really beautiful ghost. People are uncomfortable with the idea of a microphone, and it's been a slow trickle of those brave enough to stand up and tell a story when Eddie's cousin finally takes the mic. "Please," he says, "if you knew Eddie in a different way than I did, tell me a story now." He is soft and ruddy-cheeked, with small eyes made smaller by crying. "Tell me anything," he says, before sitting back down to lunch. "Give me a way to hold on to him." I had said almost the same thing to a group of friends after Aaron died, when all my memories of him were occluded by the horror of the past month. "Help me remember him," I texted, and they filled my phone with funny photos and stories until he came back to me as he'd lived, not as he'd died. I'm really struck by those last words, because I think someone who has not been where you are might be kind of shocked by that notion that, in a sense, you couldn't remember your own husband. And yet, that probably is exactly what it felt like. I mean, that you couldn't remember your husband beyond the horror of cancer.
Yeah, I think, getting back to like the loneliness piece that we had talked about, a lot of people who disappear from, you know, your life when someone is sick say things or believe this thing that, like, you know, they can't handle it. They don't want to remember somebody this way. And you do have a choice of how you remember somebody. But I did not have a choice to not see things. And there's no such thing as like a good death from cancer. And there's no such thing as a natural death from cancer. There's nothing natural about it. It takes everything from you. And your body wants to live even when it's not possible. So this young, beautiful man that I'd fallen in love with and had a family with, was not that anymore. And there's no way to impart that on people who weren't there. And part of that is, like, out of respect for Aaron, too, there are things that I would never tell anybody that we went through. But part of it is, you know, that's life. Life is death. But it's very intense. And now enough time has gone by that I don't think of Aaron as those last 2 weeks. I think of the Aaron I fell in love with. I think of the Aaron that I got to spend 3 years with. But I still do have flashbacks of those last 2 weeks. And they were very, very, they were horrifying, and they were very, very strong. And they were the kind of thing that makes it hard to remember that you had any sort of life outside of, you know, morphine and, you know, a hospital bed where your office should be. And it really changes things. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't remember, and it was killing me. I remember that night too. I was laying in the couch, and I could not bring him as he was into my memory. I could only remember like the husk of him, and I did not want that. I did not want that anymore. I did not want that to, at least I could not have that be the only thing I
had.
This, of course, brings us into another really powerful chapter in the book, chapter 40, which is titled, Is He Going to Die Soon?, in which you talk about and chronicle for us some of the amazingly inept things that people say and or ask in these situations. And, of course, we just shudder at some of what was said to you from well-meaning friends and acquaintances and relatives and so on. But what's so striking about this chapter is that the main point you want to drive home is that as unfortunate as it is, the things that people sometimes say and ask, that silence is worse. You write at one point, you're thankful for the kind things people say, you forgive the dumb things, but you're crushed by the silence. Mm-hmm. Say a word about the crushing of silence, how you experienced that.
Well, grief is difficult, and it's awkward, and especially as Westerners, especially as young Westerners, you know, I was 31 when Aaron died. We are not comfortable being uncomfortable, and we're very uncomfortable with someone else's discomfort. And there's a lot of fear. There's a fear of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, and we let that allow us to say or do nothing, which is terrible for a lot of reasons. But I had a lot of people in my life who, for whatever reason, couldn't even acknowledge what Aaron and I were going through. And the sad part is, like, a lot of those people, you know, had been a big part of Aaron's life when he was healthy. There's like, it was like a little bit Great Gatsby-ish to me that, you know, his funeral had 1,000 people at it, and our wedding had, you know, wedding crashers, and people were very effusive with what they could say on the internet, but people had a hard time being there and a hard time showing up. And there were certainly people in my life who said nothing at all, and who I know in their heart they just didn't know what to say, and they were perhaps afraid, like, they would, you know, make me sad, or, you know, remind me. There's no reminding, so, and trust me, no one ever forgets their husband is dead. You're not going to say something to me and have me be like, what? Oh, my goodness.
I haven't thought of Aaron in the longest time. And, of course, the truth is you're thinking of him all the time. And you are comforted by knowing that someone else is thinking of Aaron.
Right. And that it's not just me. And that this wasn't just meaningful to me. This was real life. This really happened. So, you know, I've gone through some of the anger stages of grief, maybe more than once. But I do get it now. I don't think that it comes from a bad place. I think it just comes from self-consciousness and people, you know, not wanting to do the wrong thing. And all I can say is that, like, you know, it does. Trying counts. So you get points for trying.
Absolutely. You say, I don't worry so much about saying the right or wrong thing anymore. And even all the stupid things that people have said have a special place in my heart because they're a sign that somebody tried. You end the chapter by saying, you may be the person who says the wrong thing, but that's better than being the one who says nothing at all. And maybe the best way you explain this is by saying at one point, most people are illiterate in the language of grief. I'm surprised by the next phrase. You say, and I count myself among that number. It surprises me that you would say that given all that you have experienced.
Yeah, there's just no, like, there's no, you know, you can't get a degree in it. You know, it's different every time. And, you know, I think even just acknowledging that awkwardness, I met this woman in the airport. We were both wearing Still Kickin' shirts, and that's the nonprofit I started after Aaron died, based on his favorite T-shirt that he was wearing the day he had a seizure. This woman's wearing the shirt, and I stop her, and I say, oh, my gosh, you're wearing my shirt. And she says, yes, you know, we're flying to Boston Children's Hospital. And she points to their daughter, and I say, cool. Mm. And then I say, no, it's not. I'm sorry. What's wrong with me? And she says, that's okay. And then she introduces me to her husband as, this is Nora. Her husband's dead. She wrote that blog. And she looks at me and she goes, sorry. I'm like, no, that's accurate. Like, it's okay to sort of, you know, bumble through these things. Like, there's no way to always know what to say when someone tells you that they have to go to, you know, a children's hospital so their daughter can have spinal surgery and she's 4 years old. There's no way. But it's okay to not be okay and to not be an expert and to let your humanity show.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's okay. And I didn't always know that. And I know that there were definitely periods of time in my life where, you know, I failed to say something and I let my own fear of imperfection or my own fear of discomfort, better put, get in the way of me trying to be there for somebody, or at least just acknowledging what somebody was going through.
You write at one point, you're talking at this point of being 4 months into widowhood, this is not a normal kind of lonely. This is a new brand of loneliness for me. I am lonely the way any person without a partner is lonely, the way that old men buying only canned soup and Oreo cookies and grocery stores are lonely. It's being lonely for the marriage we had and the life we shared together. It's a loneliness for the simple feeling of belonging to someone or having that person belong to me, like the rings we wore on our left hands, a little signal to the world that we were someone's person. I wonder, to what extent do you still experience that kind of loneliness? Is that one of the things that remains just as potent, or are there ways in which that kind of painful loneliness begins to recede?
You know, I don't know. I know a lot of women with dead husbands now, a lot. We're all in various, you know, time stages. For some, it's been, you know, 5 months now. Some, it's been 5 years. And there's no getting over it. And I am really opposed to that phrase and that idea. This is not, I think that closure is sort of a myth. We aren't meant to get over these kinds of things. These things become a part of us and they become who we are. And there are so many different kinds of days that I have. And there are days where I'm peaceful and happy and I feel grateful for, you know, what we had when we had it. And there are days when I'm still really angry that, you know, a wonderful 35-year-old man had to die, and there are awful people in this world who get to live to be like 90. It's just not how it works. Like, I know, like, our gym teachers were always like, life's not fair, but I'm like, yeah, but it's really not, and that's not cool. And there are days where I miss Aaron so much that I wake up crying, and I've since started seeing someone else, and he has had to just sort of understand that. Like, there's no replacing what I had with Aaron. There's no replicating it. And he's a person that I will always love, always. And our hearts have an amazing capacity to find and like make more love for new humans. That's like why we can have more than one child and love them both or all 10 of them, whoever. But there's no like replacing someone, and there's no replacing what we had. And a part of me will always, always, always be lonely for Aaron specifically.
Of course.
Yeah.
And at one point you write, Aaron and my father have been gone for months now, and it hurts in a different way than it did at first. I feel sometimes like an archaeologist discovering new ways to miss someone as I discover new things about them. In this case, you're talking about a little post-it note you found in Aaron's wallet after he died, saying simply, "Feel better. I love you so much. Love, Nornia." So it was from you to him. Mm-hmm. And this simple little post-it note, you came across it, and there's one more reminder of the life that you had. And yet, I assume that's something for which you're so grateful. I mean, even for the sorrow it generates, it's also generating gratitude for the life you had when you have those little discoveries.
Totally. And, you know, we don't mourn people that didn't mean something to us. And so, you know, in a way, like the fact that I feel this deeply is a sign that I loved so deeply too. But yeah, you always find something new. And, you know, on Saturday night, I was out with my sister, and we were talking, and, you know, she also is like me. She talks a lot, very loudly, and with her hands, which you can't see because we're on the radio, but I'm using my hands a lot in this interview. And I noticed my dad's wedding ring on her middle finger, and I burst into tears. And not because I didn't want her to have it. Obviously, she's first daughter. It looked beautiful on her. It made sense. But because she has it, and she has it because our dad is dead. And that is hard and sad. And so we were at a party, and I was making things awkward for people. But that is not something that I expected to have, you know, affect me. I'd never thought about it. And, you know, that's a year and a half later.
Mm-hmm. It just shows the depth of our powerful connections with each other. And of course, the sorrow that we experience, as well as the gratitude when they're no longer with us. That's certainly right. The story here, and particularly the story of your intense love for Aaron and his love for you. You say at one point he was a great partner, not in spite of his cancer or because of it, but completely apart from it. And this book is not only a story about cancer, but a story about love. The book, again, is It's Okay to Laugh, Crying is Cool Too, a memoir, published by Day Street, and the author, Nora McInerney-Permort. Thank you so much, Nora McInerney-Permort, for joining me today to talk about your wonderful book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you.
And by the way, you can learn still more about Nora's story by visiting her website and blog. The address is myhusbandstumor.com. And the subtitle of that website, it's not a cancer story, it's a love story with some cancer. And there is a feature there where she answers questions that are posed to her. And here's one that I wanted to actually share with you to finish out the morning show. Someone asked her, "Why did you write your book so soon after your husband died?" And she replied, "I didn't want to write a book 10 years later that was like, 'Hey, look at this crazy thing from a decade ago. Don't worry, everything is fine. Everything happens for a reason.' I wanted to write from the close-up, the chaos and the wreckage of grief, because that's a perspective, too. I wrote the book I wanted to read while my life was falling apart, and I couldn't write that years later. I had to write it now." Norma McInerney-Permort. And again, her memoir is called It's Okay to Laugh, Crying is Okay Too. Tomorrow on the morning show, Craig Gall, the music director of the Kenosha Pops Band, offers a preview of this summer's season at Pinoyer Park. And we hear from Melissa Snoza, who is the